So maybe before starting to do any further readings, maybe just check and see if anybody has any questions and see if that. Yes, Jennifer.
You talked about having lost a great deal of institutional knowledge in the forest tradition through the sort of indigent monk and not having monasteries. Do you think Ajahn Chah wanted to have that sort of institutional passed down knowledge from Ajahn Mun? And is that why he had lots of monasteries?
Well, there's many reasons. One is, say, like the monasteries. There was a big change taking place culturally in Thailand in the late 1950s, and as Ajahn Chah was starting to develop his own monastery himself, and then into the 1960s. And that's that with the encouragement and the beginning of a cash economy, then within 2 or 3 decades, the vast majority of forests were actually destroyed in Thailand. It didn't take very long. So that the actual, how do you say, venue for these wandering itinerant monks was pretty much gone. So that I think that plays a part, and that happened not just with Ajahn Chah, but the vast majority of other forest monks. What they did was start to they see it, you look around, you see, wow, it's disappearing all around us. We'd better establish something. And that's where they started to settle in forests, and whether they were small or large, then they were protectors of the forest. And that has carried on to today, and in fact has sort of escalated so that there's a an increasing in the beginning, then there was a lot of resistance amongst the say the Department of Forestry. They didn't want these monks camping out in their forest. And who are they? What are they doing? And in some, it's just sort of the it doesn't fit into the model of how they do things. In others, it was they got in the way of the ability to make more money off merchants coming and cutting the forests. So there was a lot of it happened very, very quickly. So that again in Thai the word for a wandering monk is sort of like a tudong monk, tudong, and Ajahn Chah would play a word, and he says nowadays there aren't any tudong monks left. There's only Thalut Dong monks, and Thalut Dong is a word for forest, and Thalut means to pass through. So it's just all of a sudden there's a forest and you're through it already. There's nothing left. So a lot of the effort that was made was to create places of practice that were out of the city, that were quiet places. And of course, with the incredible urbanization that's taken place in Thailand, some of the forest monasteries that were established are now, say, there's one branch monastery of Wat Bapong that was established way on the outskirts of Bangkok. And now it's got like three housing estates on three sides. And it's definitely lost its flavor. So it's facing the just trying to deal with the changing situation in the culture and the society.
Mm-hmm. But now there's this great institutional knowledge, which
has
the result of that.
It's true, and there is almost a systematization, which has benefits and drawbacks. Mm-hmm. So the forest monks are learning to be a bit more how to work with the powers that be a bit more. Whereas before they were really just off; they could just step out and just not be noticed. Mm-hmm. So. Yes.
When you and other Western seekers went to Thailand, I'm interested to know, of course, Jack and Joseph and other teachers of lay people, and then yourself and Ajahn Amaro and maybe others in the monastic tradition, could you say something about how the teachings are the same or different between the monastic and the lay tradition that came from Ajahn Chah? Mm-hmm. And anything else you could help us relate as lay people to the teachings and the tradition of the monastic establishment?
Yeah. When the first Westerner who came to stay with Ajahn Chah was Ajahn Sumedho, 1967. And he showed up, and the first contact that Ajahn Chah ever had with a Westerner. Ubon was, prior to that, probably the only Western contact. Well, that's not true. There was started to be an American Air Force base in Ubon. I think there was probably 15,000 Air Force personnel in there, because it was close. Ubon is closer. Is during the Vietnam War as it was escalating, and the it was closer to Hanoi and Saigon than it was to Bangkok geographically. So it was a great place for fighter bomber base. It's one of the things I brought with me from Thailand to Ubayagiri. Is if anybody's been to Ubayagiri, there's the bell in the central courtyard. That's a bomb casing. Good American bomb.
Awesome.
So brought it for another purpose. Ah, it's got a ringer, yeah. We've got it. It's actually because they're good metal. They're all over Thailand.
as bells,
monastery bells. yeah. Bombs the bells, yeah. So that was maybe Ajahn Chah might have seen a bit, but certainly somebody who showed up to train at the monastery had never happened. So his way of when Ajahn Sumedho first came, one of the things that he said to Ajahn Sumedho, yeah, you can come and stay here, you have to live like everybody else. That was something that Ajahn Sumedho had been studying in Bangkok. He'd been in another place in the north of the northeast of Thailand, and he'd always got special dispensation because he was a Westerner. And Ajahn Chah didn't do that. You'll have to learn how to live like everybody else here. And that was That was extremely useful for training. In terms of you know, actual teachings, of course, there's a different flavor for teaching monastics and teaching lay people. And Ajahn Chah had a very you know, devoted and extensive base of lay people coming to the monastery, and of course not Westerners, but still, there, when you're living in the monastery, you see, you know, these different ways of emphasis and teaching, but still, his, the flavor of commitment and renunciation are there, or integrity, very strong. Ajahn Chah, whether it was to lay people or to monastics, he, one of the bases of his teaching, the foundation, is really around virtue and right understanding. Like, those are the foundations that all practice has to be built up on. So that that whether one's a living in the world as a layperson or living in a monastery, that's the if you really want to grow in the practice in terms of meditation, in terms of wisdom, that's the base that you have to grow up from. And so that was very, very, very strong. And I remember when I first went to Ajahn Chah's monastery, and of course it's on a regular day, you come in, it's quite quiet, there's a few lay people around, and then it's the observance night a few days later on the lunar quarters, and boom, there's the monastery is full of lay people, and they're taking precepts, they're meditating, they're listening to Dhamma talks, and it's not just that they're meditating. I mean, they're really meditating, and I'm sitting here squirming, and this is all night, every once a week, all night session in meditation and chanting and Dhamma practice, and it's, you know, it's not like even nowadays with Ajahn Chah passed away for 20 years or almost 16, 17, 18 years. You know, I'd say there's, you know, on an average or on a regular weekly observance day, there's about 200 lay people show up, and it's just they're there to practice. They're solid. And so that you know, strong commitment to meditation and practice, and Ajahn Chah encouraging them, and then them taking up on it. And so, but I think it all comes back to that emphasis that Ajahn Chah made, that whatever practice you do, really get those foundations right. It's virtue and right view.
What would you say that the primary characteristics that distinguish Thai Buddhism from like Tibetan Kadampa or Japanese Zen?
Well, I mean, to say Thai Buddhism is not is a bit of a there's a lot of Buddhism in Thailand. A lot of different flavors, a lot of different expressions, a lot of different ways of practice. But in terms of, say, my experience with, say, Ajahn Chah's training in the, say, from the northeast of Thailand, is a one, there's an emphasis on communal practice. Whether it's communal practice as a monastic living in community, or as a lay practitioner embedded in the community of practitioners that you're in around the monastery. So there's a sense of communality, so that there's individual practice, but it's in relationship to others. So that's a strong flavor. I think there's a very strong sense of practicality, down to earthness of the say the northeastern Thai temperament, and that's a flavor that it's really. It's not philosophical. You're not going to end up in long sort of discursive projections about the ultimate reality. It's more around what do you do and what's the results of what you do, and does it make you feel better or not? So there's that kind of earthiness and very directness that I really appreciate. So that you know, that's a distinctive flavor, I think. Okay, should I go on? Mm-hmm. One more.
Personally, today was my first exposure to walking meditation.
Uh huh.
So just regarding the topic of walking meditation, there's not much I know about that, and only maybe slightly more I know about, I guess you'd call it, sitting meditation. Can you just maybe spend a couple more minutes talking about the mindset or maybe the movements or,
okay,
I guess, okay, tips and tricks of the trade, kind of like what because
okay,
it was impactful. It was very impactful, and I didn't anticipate that.
Right,
and I'd
right.
like to know a little bit more about what to do with it.
Okay. Maybe when we begin the walking meditation, I'll give a bit more instruction around that. Okay. I'll carry on with Ajahn Chah before we have another sit. So we left Ajahn Chah with him walking out of Lung Po Man's monastery after only receiving a couple days of instruction. He was there for 3 days, and manuscript, it's actually explained a bit more fully. One of the reasons for that is that in Thailand there's two major sects of Buddhism, and there's sort of the larger and the smaller sect, and the smaller is called Dhammayutta, and it's called it's probably maybe 10% of the monastic population, but Ajahn Mun belonged to that sect, and Ajahn Chah belonged to the Mahanikai, which is the larger grouping, and it wasn't so convenient for them to stay in each other's monasteries. It's just the way it goes. There's politics in everything. It was one of the questions that Ajahn Chah asked Lung Po Man, was because many, many of the disciples of Ajahn Mun in those days were relinquishing their ordination with the Mahanikai sect and reordaining to be able to stay with Lung Po Man. And Ajahn Chah actually asked him, should I reordain to be a part of, to be able to live closer. And he said no. And he actually said, Mahanikai needs good monks as well. So that he could probably, you know, his psychic abilities were renowned. And one can only assume, Ajahn Mun never said anything, Ajahn Chah never said anything, so one can only assume that he probably saw that, yeah, Ajahn Chah is probably going to be a teacher who's going to have some influence in the and there's say one reason for it that has been suggested is that just prior to Ajahn Chah's visit, one of Lumpa Mun's senior disciples saw Ubon split off from the rest of the northeast of Thailand. This is in a meditative vision. It's said that Lumpa Mun considered this a sign that Ubon would not be a stronghold for the Dhammayut forest monks in the future, and he recognized in Ajahn Chah the monk who had spread the forest tradition to the Mahanikai order and build monasteries in Ubon. So, and that's very much the case nowadays. If you go out from Ubon in any direction, you're going to run into a monastery of Ajahn Chah's. And so that, so then he studied and trained with a couple other monks. And of the monks that Ajahn Chah looked up to and praised to his disciples, the two that took pride of place, apart from Lumpu Mun, were Lumpu Thonglat and Lumpu Kinnerly. These two monks were friends. They belonged to the small fraternity of Lumpu Mun's disciples who maintained their affiliation with the Mahanikai sect. Their personalities could hardly have been more different. While Lumpu Thonglat was fierce and unconventional, Lumpu Kinnerly was quiet and unobtrusive. Ajahn Chah praised Lumpu Thonglat's fearlessness and sense of humor, Lumpu Kinnerly's simplicity, his ability to maintain mindfulness in all postures, and his patient attention to detail. It was with Lumpu Kinnerly that Ajahn Chah had the most contact. He spent little time with Lumpu Thonglat. Indeed, no record survives of exactly when and how often they met, although their first meeting has become legendary thanks to Lumpu Thonglat's greeting of the young monk he'd never met before with the words, "So you're Chah, are you?" Ajahn Chah's relationship to Lumpu Kinnerly is clearer. It began in that hot season of 1948 and lasted until the latter's death in 1979. In the last years of Lumpu Kinnerly's life, he was cared for by monks sent from Wat Bapong by Ajahn Chah. Lumpu Kinnerly had led an eventful monastic life. After receiving teachings from Lumpu Mun and Lumpu Sao was a contemporary of Ajahn Mun, was actually older and was his teacher, first meditation teacher, and then it was, but he wasn't, say, enlightened yet. Lumpu Mun came back and taught Lumpu Sao, and then sort of the teacher became enlightened after that as well. So it was, he had spent many years wandering on Tudong, including over 10 years in Burma. He was one of only a handful of monks of his generation to have visited the Buddhist holy places in northeast India. That's walking there. Yet by the time Ajahn Chah knew him, Lumpu Kinnerly did not have the air of a hardened seasoned traveler. He wore about him, like an old well-used robe, a modest self-sufficiency and ease that spoke of someone with nothing more to prove to himself. He seemed content with what each moment brought him. Ajahn Chah soon found that the fact that he rarely spoke was not merely taciturnity, but rather the fruit of a sweet, gentle nature, so at home in silence that he rarely saw reason to disturb it with speech. He was an industrious man who would spend his days tinkering, pottering, sewing, cleaning. All of his requisites he made himself and used them until they fell apart. As he got older, his appearance became even more shabby and decrepit. But as Ajahn Chah discovered, his mind remained bright and clean. Ajahn Chah's initial visit to Lumpu Kinnerly's monastery was a short one. He found Lumpu Kinnerly's customarily elliptic and poetical advice on practice hard to understand, and yet intriguing. Every now and again, a blunter teaching got through. He was impressed enough to decide to return for the rains. And this is Ajahn Chah speaking. At that time, I'd hear the teachers giving Dhamma talks about letting go. Letting go. And I still couldn't really understand. Lumpu Kinnerly asked me to sew a set of robes. I went at it flat out. I wanted to get it over and done with quickly. Once the task was done, I thought, I'd be free of business and able to get down to some meditation. One day, Lumpu walked over. I was sewing out in the sun, totally unaware of the heat. I just wanted to get finished so that I could devote myself to meditation. He asked me, what's the hurry? I'm hurrying to get finished. When you've finished, what are you going to do? I'm going to meditate. After you've done that, what are you going to do? I'm going to do so-and-so. Then when you finish that, what are you going to do? I'm going to do so-and-so. And then what will you do? There would be no end of this, he said. Don't you realize that it's just this sewing that is your meditation? Where are you rushing off to? You've already gone wrong. Craving is flooding through your head and you've no idea what's going on. Another shaft of life. I'd been sure I was making merit, I was doing good. I'd thought merely doing the job was good enough. I'd get it done quickly and go on to something else. But Lumpu pointed out my mistake. What was the hurry? One of the things for even if you're a forest monk and you're wandering, you'll almost always have one or two monks with you, or a novice, a layperson. It's very rare in Thailand to actually to be on your own. I mean, it's a they're very social people, and even if you're a monk, you'd still you'd at least two or three or four. I mean, just wandering on your own is pretty rare. At one point, Ajahn Chah just got really resistant to being with anybody, so he went off to stay in a small monastery on his own completely. So this is in the deserted monastery he dwelt in. Small signs of former inhabitants were all around him. There were discolored books behind the altar, eaten through by termites, candle wax drippings on the floor. It was a created solitude, one born of rejection, and so was sad in a way that the most remote mountaintop or cave could never be. One day, to his exasperation, Ajahn Chah began to feel lonely. I started thinking, it would be good to have a small novice or an Anagarika to help out with a few odd jobs around here. But then other thoughts started to challenge that line of thought. You're really something. Only a short time ago you were fed up with your companions. So now why do you want to find some more? Then he said, yes, it's true I was fed up, but only with people who aren't good companions. Right now I need a good companion. So where are the good people? Can you search them out? You haven't been satisfied with any of your traveling companions so far. You must think you're the only good person around to have left them behind and come here alone. Ajahn Chah said that when that thought arose, he had an insight that he was to make use of from that day onwards. Where is the good person? He lies within us. If we're good, then wherever we go, the goodness stays with us. People may praise us, blame us, or treat us with contempt. But whatever they say or do, we're still good. Without goodness, our mind constantly wavers. We're angered by criticism and pleased by praise. Through knowing where the good person dwells, we have a principle to rely on in letting go of thought. If we go somewhere where people dislike us or say things about us, then we don't consider that to be because they're good or bad. We know that goodness and badness lie within us. Nobody can know us as well as we know ourselves.